Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today, we are joined by Bruce Segaris. Bruce Segaris is partner with Berliner, Corcoran & Rowe, and is also an adjunct professor of law at Texas A&M. And Bruce is serving as the vice chair of our International Criminal Law Committee for the Criminal Justice Section. So Bruce is joining us today to talk about the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 and talk about its importance in the changes that it brings to U.S. money laundering since the USA Patriot Act in 2001. So, Bruce, why don't you tell our listeners why the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 is so significant?
Sure, there's all kinds of different reasons. One of them is that the U.S. has been trying since 2006 to enact beneficial ownership legislation. And they finally did. It's called the Corporate Transparency Act. And the reason it's significant is that since 2006, the Financial Action Task Force has evaluated the U.S. as non-compliant in entity transparency. They were evaluated again in 2016 and again found non-compliant. So this is important. In addition, the act significantly increases penalties for anti-money laundering and terrorist financing violations. It enlarges the quality and the quantity of enforcement resources and strengthens the ability to obtain records about correspondent bank accounts. It also strengthens the ability of the Financial Crime Center of Treasury to undertake international enforcement in financial crimes and anti-money laundering by establishing FinCEN liaisons abroad. So now FinCEN's going to have a number of liaisons in U.S. embassies abroad. The act also strengthens significantly the whistleblower provisions and also provides for kleptocracy assistance, thereby strengthening the ability to recover the proceeds of foreign corruption at a time when the Biden administration just on June 3rd issued a memorandum that says corruption is a core national security matter. And just this week, the G7 communique prioritizes anti-corruption and getting the proceeds of corruption crimes. The act also has new provisions on cryptocurrency and antiquities dealers, advisors, and consultants, thereby enabling regulators and law enforcement to maintain efforts over new and growing types of money laundering. In addition, the expanded purposes of the Bank Secrecy Act now covers illicit finance. More specifically, it will enable regulators and law enforcement to broaden the scope of their remit to areas such as sanctions, human trafficking, and other forms of criminal activity. So that's just a highlight of some of the significant provisions, but clearly the act is the most significant change since 2001 in U.S. anti-money laundering and terrorist financing law.
Great, thank you. Bruce, you mentioned the Corporate Transparency Act. Would you tell us more about that? What do our listeners need to know about this act that are part of the new law?
Sure. So Section 3 of the act requires new and existing small companies and limited liability companies to disclose information about their beneficial owners. So the formation agents of these small companies and limited liability companies will now have to transmit to FinCEN at Treasury information on the beneficial owners, namely the full legal name, the date of birth, and the current residential or business street address, and also a copy of the U.S. passport or personal identification card or a non-expired driver's license issued by a state. So the question is, what is the beneficial owner? The Act defines beneficial owner as an individual who exercises substantial control over a corporation or limited liability company, or a person who owns 25% or more of the interest in a corporation or limited liability company, or receives substantial economic benefits from the assets of a corporation or limited liability company. And there still need to be regulations to, you know, more fully define all of those definitions. And then there's a question of who must file and who is excluded. The Corporate Transparency Act exempts a lot of categories of entities from the reporting requirement. So in particular, the Act exempts dormant companies, entities that are filing reports with other agencies, such as banks, investment companies, insurance companies, public utilities, public accounting firms, and publicly trading companies who already file with the Securities Exchange Commission or the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. It also exempts churches, charities, nonprofit entities, lower risk entities, such as larger private companies that have real operations in the US, companies employing more than 20 individuals and filing a tax return, reporting gross receipts of more than $5 million and with a physical presence in the United States, and any entity that's owned by an exempt entity. So you can see there's a lot of exemptions or exclusions. And that's because, as I mentioned, there is a lot of political opposition. And Congress struggled since 2006 to pass this law. And the only way it passed at this time was to make a lot of compromises. And because the law is really designed only to counteract shell companies. And so the law then is narrowly tailored to, you know, target those shell companies. And that contrasts with the beneficial ownership provisions, for instance, in the European Union's fifth anti-money laundering directive, which is much broader. It even covers trusts. So, and then there's a question of who's going to have access to this beneficial ownership information. Well, the Act says that law enforcement agencies at the local, state, federal, and tribal level will all have access, as will financial institutions with legally mandated anti-money laundering obligations after they get the consent of their depositors. In addition, foreign law enforcement authorities can request the information pursuant to a treaty, such as a mutual legal assistance treaty or letters rogatory or another statutory provision. So access to beneficial ownership information is rather limited compared, again, to the EU, which makes beneficial ownership information accessible to the public. So in contrast, there are strict penalties in the Corporate Transparency Act that penalize anyone who gives out information that shouldn't be given out, including it penalizes federal officials. So, and the law provides that not later than 1 year from the enactment or by January of 2021, Treasury must issue regulations to implement the Act and to, for instance, clarify some of these definitions. So, and once the Act becomes law, existing entities will have 2 years to report, whereas new entities must report shortly after formation. It's likely, though, to take possibly until 2024 or even 2025 before the regulations become effective, because, you know, after they're issued, the public is going to have a time to comment. There'll be hearings, there'll be, you know, redrafts, and then the Treasury will provide, once it issues the final regulations, they probably won't be effective until 30 or 90 days into the future. So it's going to take a while.
Well, thank you for all of that background and context, and also helping us remember some of the history of this and some of the obstacles that have brought us to this point, this happening in 2020. So I'd like to know more about new authority. Does the law give U.S. law enforcement any new authority, especially with respect to international transactions and situations?
Yes. So already the USA Patriot Act gave the Department of Justice and Treasury in certain circumstances the right to issue subpoenas on correspondent accounts in the U.S. And now this has been expanded. The act now permits the Justice Department to request any records relating to the correspondent account or any account of the foreign bank that has a correspondent account in the U.S., including records maintained outside the U.S. As long as the records are subject to an investigation concerning a violation of U.S. criminal laws, a violation of the Bank Secrecy Act, or a civil forfeiture action, or even Section 5318A investigation. That's an investigation where the FinCEN believes that there's a transaction or a bank or even a country that's a primary money laundering concern. And if the foreign financial institution, after it receives one of these subpoenas, it can try to contest it in the U.S., but if it does not succeed, the act then authorizes the Attorney General to seek contempt sanctions from a court. And in addition, the Attorney General or Secretary of the Treasury may direct covered U.S. financial institutions to end their correspondent relationships with the non-compliant foreign financial entity and impose penalties on those U.S. institutions that fail to do so. So it can, you know, basically eliminate the foreign bank from having U.S. banking relationships.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned an impact on whistleblower law earlier. What does this law do for whistleblowers? And does this enable foreign governments to recover the proceeds of corruption?
Yes. So until now, foreign governments have had difficulty maintaining civil actions in the U.S. to hold accountable persons participating in criminal activity, such as corruption, tax crimes, fraud, drug trafficking, etc. I mean, the courts have said that these foreign governments trying to use the RICO laws, they've dismissed their lawsuits. And the ones that have tried to recover, for instance, tax proceeds have also, for the most part, not succeeded. So there are two important provisions under the new act, the whistleblower provisions and the Kleptocracy Recovery Rewards Act that assists foreign governments. So let's look first at the whistleblower provisions. Even before the enactment of the act, the Bank Secrecy Act authorized payments to whistleblowers. However, Treasury could not pay more than $150,000, and Treasury had discretion on whether to do that. So the new act requires the Treasury Secretary to pay an award to persons who furnish original information resulting in successful enforcement of several money laundering laws. And the new provisions emulate the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act whistleblower provisions, which have been used a lot. And the new provisions eliminate the $150,000 award limit. So instead, the payment ceiling is 30% of the government's collection if the monetary sanctions imposed are greater than $1 million. So, and then the law sets forth what the government should consider in deciding the amount of the award. It has to consider the significance of the information, the extent of assistance furnished, and the programmatic interest of Treasury in preventing violations. The whistleblower can appeal a decision not to make the award, but has no right to appeal the amount of the award. So we're still awaiting regulations, but one of the usual issues is whether the whistleblower has actually caused the penalties to have been obtained by the government. And the new whistleblower protection provisions also forbid retaliation by employers, and the whistleblower can appeal to the Department of Labor if he is retaliated against. So he or she can try to enforce these provisions. So there's also the Kleptocracy Assets Recovery Reward Act. And under the new provisions of this act, which has the acronym CARA, the Secretary of the Treasury, and in consultation with other heads of federal departments or agencies, can pay a reward to any individual that provides information leading to the restraining or seizure of stolen assets in an account at a U.S. financial institution, or forfeiture of stolen assets, again, at an account of a U.S. financial institution, or repatriation of those stolen assets. And financial assets are defined very broadly. They include any funds, investments, or ownership interests. And it appears that they involve all kinds of investments in businesses, real estate, and portfolio investment. So the Treasury is going to have to establish procedures on offering, administering, and paying these rewards. But this should also be, you know, very significant in terms of helping foreign governments obtain the proceeds of foreign government corruption. And even foreign government corruption is defined as not only bribery of a foreign official, but also misappropriation, theft, or embezzlement of public funds or property by or for the benefit of a foreign public official. So these two provisions will significantly help in recovering foreign government proceeds of corruption.
Mm-hmm. And now I'm sure everybody is naturally trying to take in all this information about the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 and think of what implications it'll be for their industry or their clients, respectively. Before we spoke today, you mentioned that the antiquities business, this would be impacted in an interesting way. So would you tell our listeners about what the new law says with respect to professionals in the antiquities business?
Sure. So the law expands the definition of a financial institution under the law. And it now includes a person engaged in the trade of antiquities, including an advisor, consultant, or other person who engages as a business in the solicitation or the sale of antiquities, subject to regulations which the secretary is going to have to issue. And the act also requires Treasury to prepare a study within 1 year that evaluates money laundering and terrorist financing through not only antiquities, but also the art trade. And it's likely that art dealers are eventually going to be subject to anti-money laundering law. And that's because there's been a series of recent law enforcement actions. So in January 2017, the Justice Department filed a civil action against Hobby Lobby for importing thousands of cuneiform tablets and other antiquities allegedly looted from Iraq, and they had to, you know, forfeit the goods and pay a $3 million fine. In addition, in January 2018, the Manhattan DA's office seized 450,000 in allegedly looted antiquities from a New York art dealer, the Phoenix Fine Art. And also, just last year, the Senate Permanent Investigative Committee held a hearing on the use of shell companies that were mentioned in the Panama Papers to help a Russian sanctioned person move $18 million worth of high-end art through four auction houses. And even though these auction houses had voluntary anti-money laundering programs, they didn't bother to ask the Moscow-based art advisor who made the purchases who his client was. And so that now has led to a lot of demand to subject not only antiquities dealers, but also art dealers to anti-money laundering laws. So you can see that the scope of anti-money laundering law is broadening as a result of this act. And again, here, I should mention that already the European Union's anti-money laundering directive covers antiquities dealers and art dealers. So that's a, you know, the act follows a trend.
Mm-hmm. Certainly wasn't expecting to hear Hobby Lobby and anti-money laundering in the same conversation. Oh, thank you, though, for those examples and for helping us understand that. So, Bruce, you mentioned there will be a period of comment and trials and things like that. Before we close, for our listeners, can you give us any insight into what to look for or where to follow along with these developments?
Great question. One thing is that the criminal justice section is organizing comments. And so Mara Sen and myself are coordinating the comments on the regulation. Some of the other sections in the ABA are also going to be organizing comments because there are just thousands of questions in, for instance, the Corporate Transparency Act about, you know, who's a formation agent or, you know, how the definition of beneficial owner will be decided when there's, let's say, multiple tiers of owners. And so the question of this 25% ownership or, you know, who is controlling is going to require some careful regulation. And there'll be, you know, people will be on different sides of the regulation, you know, depending on, you know, who they represent and what their perspectives are on, you know, how the act should be implemented.
All right. Well, thank you again, Bruce, for sharing all of that with us and for giving us an update on what the section will be doing. All right. And again, listeners, this was Bruce Zegaris, partner with Berliner, Corcoran, and Rowe, adjunct professor at Texas A&M. So thank you again, and thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.